Hi, this is Todd Haymore, Secretary of Agriculture and Forestry for the Commonwealth of Virginia. I listen to Heritage Radio Network.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Will Harris, and today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
Good morning. It's Wednesday. It's 11 o'clock, and you're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday morning, live from Roberta's, we talk about my favorite subject, and I hope it's one of yours, taste. Actually, we talk about taste and food and sometimes nutrition and all sorts of things. And today, we're going to be talking about a particular type of taste that is dear to my heart. That's the taste for wonderful restaurants. We have with us in the studio Kate Crater, who is the restaurant editor of Food & Wine magazine, and you might follow her on Twitter, or maybe you're one of her many thousands of fans on Facebook, but certainly you're one of the millions of subscribers to Food & Wine, which is a magazine that really covers the chef movement that we're in the midst of in a unique and wonderfully exciting way. So we're very happy to have you here at Roberta's.
Good morning.
Good morning. I understand it's one of the few times you've been here in daylight.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Once or twice. Yeah. I think I've seen it in daylight, but it's a whole different...
It is a different vibe. And actually, now we actually have an on-air sign that's projecting into from the studio into the restaurant, so people know we're on air. I'm not sure if that's going to make it any quieter, maybe noisier. You never know with this Brooklyn crowd.
It's gorgeous.
So thank you for coming here. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the air, besides loving you and loving to talk with you, is that you just have such a great perspective on the really exciting time I think we're in the midst of here with restaurants and chefs in America, in New York City certainly, but you have a breadth that spans the whole country and even outside the rest of the world. So what do you see that's going on? Tell me what we're in the midst of.
You know what? It's a really exciting time. For one thing, we just announced our best new chefs for 2012, and for us that's like Christmas. You know, kids get excited on Christmas Eve. We get excited. It's Christmas in April. With Food & Wine.
But so tell us a little bit about what that is and what the process is.
Your Best New Chefs has been going on, I think, for about 25 years. Wow. And we've been really great talent spotters, if I do say so myself. We've picked Thomas Keller and Daniel Balud and Nobu Matsuhisa as Best New Chefs, like right from the beginning.
Right.
So we feel like we have a really good eye. And so every year we look for chefs who we think are like up and coming and going to make their mark and doing brilliant personal food.
And we is the editorial board? Okay.
We is the editorial board, the Food & Wine editors. And there's not that much criteria, but they have to have been in charge of a professional kitchen for no more than 5 years. So
okay.
6 years, sorry. We can't let you be Best New Chef.
So after 25 years, that's you've picked a lot of chefs.
Picked a lot of chefs. Yeah. We've picked some really great ones. And this year we feel like is an extraordinarily good class. We found chefs. We always, I have to say, like we really search high and low and in every corner of America. And this year we have a chef, Blaine Wetzel, who's from Lummi Island. I think I've been saying it wrong. I keep saying Lummi. Lummi.
It's Lummi.
I think it's Lummi Island.
And his restaurant's name is?
Is Willow's Inn. Yeah. And it's in like the most remote corner of the Pacific Northwest you can imagine. It's an island that I feel like I saw it in a murder mystery somewhere. Like, lots of crazy things can happen there.
Which did not stop you from going there to eat in this restaurant.
I'm very brave. Right. I'm so brave. I just went out there. But it's a really lovely inn. And I think he does like once a week, he does a supper. And it's not once a week. Maybe it's a couple times a week. But he does this multi-course supper. And he cooked at NoMa, you know, which has been called the world's best restaurant, voted the world's best restaurant. So he cooked there, and he does this really amazing food. Like, he goes on the beaches and finds, like, herbs and flowers, and he has two fishing boats that provide the majority of the food on the menu, and it's a kind of place where people wouldn't see that much possibility there, and he sees every possibility there and just does this
amazing... How big a restaurant is it?
It's about 25 seats, maybe, 30 seats.
Small.
And you have to catch a ferry to get there, and if you miss the ferry and you miss the 6:30 seating, I don't know if you have to eat in the kitchen or the parking lot or how that goes. We just made our ferry to get there. but it's like a magic kingdom. It was so great.
So any place easier to get to for dinner that we might tell people listening
yes.
that excites you?
Well, for anyone in New York City, we actually have two, we found two groups of chefs. One of them is at one of my favorite restaurants called Teresi Italian Specialties.
Sure, one of my favorites too.
Yay, Teresi. it's these two guys who came up with some of the MVPs in the New York City restaurant scene. One of them cooked a lot with Mario Batali. Mm-hmm. At his restaurants, and then the other one cooked with Daniel Boulud, especially at Cafe Boulud, mm-hmm. and that's where they both met. And they both of them have an Italian American background and a passion for Italian American food, and they wanted to resurrect it. They felt like it'd been like, you know, just become this stupid cliche, and so they were like, "We're going to bring it back. We're going to do the best meatball sub ever." And so they did. They started, they're like these sandwich mavericks. And
right. They sandwich mavericks. We'll get back to that.
We are going to get back to that. They're sandwich mavericks, but they also did a fantastic, and still do, a 5-course tasting menu. So by day, their restaurant was this terrific deli. And then at night, it turned into a different kind of magic kingdom, like this little 18-seat restaurant where they did these 5-course tasting menus that cost like $50, and they would hand make the mozzarella, so the first thing you'd get is this little ball of warm mozzarella floating in this delicious creamy oily sea, and then they served it with the best garlic bread you've ever had. Like, I've eaten a lot of garlic bread in my life, and this was all time awesome garlic bread.
Wow. Okay. So there are plenty more that we can talk about, mm-hmm. of the specific chefs. But one thing I'm curious is, since Food and Wine's been doing this for so long, is there anything you see in this particular class or in this over the last few years that distinguishes what's happened before with what's going on now? We keep talking about on this show, but in general in the food world, that so many things have changed. There's a new generation of chefs cooking, you know, perhaps a more personal style of food, not so French, not so Italian. I mean, even the Teresi guys, it's an Italian idiom, but they do a lot of things that reflect Chinese and Jewish stuff going on in the neighborhood that they are.
Yeah.
Do you see what's going on?
It's a really good question. I think there's so much first and second generation things happening now. And since the economy took a dive in 2008, you know, we worried. We thought, like, what is going to happen to our Best New Chef program now? Because there's not that many. Traditionally, we had looked for chefs who were at white tablecloth restaurants who had one of those toque chef, mm-hmm. chef hats on their heads. And that started to change. In, like, 2006, we picked David Chang as Best New Chef, who's uh-huh. known for his mamafuku, for, like, sitting at a counter and eating, like, a sick bowl of ramen. So we had started to already, you know, move away from or look beyond. Of course, we still love to recognize chefs who are doing fantastic and elegant food.
Right.
But we thought the way people are eating now and the way it's going, it's, you know, it's a sort of new comfort food era, and we need to recognize that. We don't just want to pick someone who's doing a good burger, but if they have a brilliant take on a burger or a brilliant take on a bowl of ramen, as David Chang did, or in L.A., Roy Choi has his Kogi barbecue truck, we feel like we have to recognize that because it's making a huge impact. And so one thing we've seen in the last couple of years especially is chefs taking, I think it's a couple things, but one of them is if they have this Italian-American heritage that they're proud of, or in the case of another Best New Chef this year is Brian Nigg, mm-hmm. who is at Spice Table in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. His family, he comes from a Singaporean background and his wife is Vietnamese, so he's taken Southeast Asian food, but given it like his California, modern California slant. He worked with Nancy Silverton at Mozza for a long time, so he, you know, he has like a graduate degree in California cooking. So he managed to meld those two things together, and it's just so cool. It's
amazing.
A fantastic time, I think, especially if you have a little perspective on what some of that food is and uh-huh. like where it's going now. It's so exciting.
It almost sounds like we're making good on the promise we always talk about at the Beard Foundation of James Beard's Celebration of American Cuisine, that actually these different melting pot cultures are beginning to emerge and being reflective of really the multicolored fabric that is America in food.
It's so true. It really is.
Yeah, that's very exciting. I'll remind people listening at home that if you have any questions for Kate about restaurants or maybe the next list, which they're probably already thinking about, you can call us at the studio at 718-497-2128. You can also write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.com. And if you're one of the many thousands of people listening on iTunes to the podcast, why don't you tweet us at Taste Matters HRM. And actually, we should give everyone your Twitter handle, Kate, because you are a great Twitterer.
Thank you.
Well, I love to follow you. What is it?
It's at K Crader.
At K Crader. K-R-A-D-E-R.
Exactly.
So, melting pot food. I'd love to just talk a little bit about the rising relationship between chefs and restaurants and magazines, because I think that, you know, certainly my personal experience and even some of my academic research is about the relationship between media and food culture, and I think that they're very closely connected. And I wonder if you could talk about your position as restaurant editor at this food magazine, which seems like you might want to take it for granted, but maybe isn't such an old traditional thing.
Yeah, we haven't always had a restaurant editor. It's definitely started in the last 6 or 7 years. I wasn't the first restaurant editor, mm-hmm.
But you're the best.
I'm the best. I think it just reflects, we're very trend-focused at Food & Wine, and we love chefs, and we love what they're doing, and we think they impact the way people are eating and the way people get excited about food and trends all over the place. So we love to watch chefs. I mean, we do feel like we also love artisans, you know, and it's a right. good time to do that. You know, in some ways, the spotlight for such a long time, the chef celebrity phenomenon is relatively new,
sure.
but it's been so impactful. You know, you see all these people like Bobby Flay's a celebrity now,
right? And like an A-list celebrity on a red carpet for the Academy Awards, not just for the James Beard Awards,
exactly.
which are coming up.
Yeah. And we were just saying, like, if you watch Gossip Girl, there's not like a week that goes by that they're not name checking like April Bloomfield at the Spotted Pig or Andrew Carmellini at the Dutch. You know, like it's become such a part of popular culture. So we love to watch what chefs are doing, but we're also broadening. We also are obsessed with what artisans are doing, what the people who work with chefs and
right.
how they cook and what they do. And
by artisans, I mean it's everything from knife makers to cheese makers to
exactly.
picklers.
To
I mean,
butchers.
We're here in Brooklyn in Ground Zero in some ways for a type of food artisanship that's actually the cover story of New York Magazine this week. It's both tongue-in-cheek and also it just so happens, you know, you can get some really good things around here, made right here.
No, it's amazing. Like, I should mention that the awesome chef at Roberta's, Carlo Maracci, was the best new chef last year. Like, we just saw what he was doing here at Roberta's, and I'm actually looking at a table with all the settings for pizza on it. I'm getting really hungry. Just
and
thinking about Carlo.
Hard to imagine 15 years ago, 10 years ago, that this restaurant would be on your best new chef list. I mean, to your earlier point.
Well, it wouldn't have been.
Right.
You know, I think, honestly, it's like what he's doing. I would like to think it would be, but it wouldn't have existed.
Like,
it
there
wouldn't have been.
You know, we leave here sometimes at 11:30, and there are tables of guys in suits, you know, having business meetings here in Bushwick at this. I mean, if I could describe it, if you haven't been here, you should all come here, no matter mm-hmm. where you're listening to us. But it looks like you just built a restaurant, you know, yourselves, and I think they did.
I have to say, I think me and Mitchell could have built this restaurant, and that's not saying, no offense, Mitchell, but that's not saying very much.
No, but we certainly couldn't have consistently made such delicious food, I don't think.
I would say no.
Let's talk about that, because, of course, at a magazine, restaurants are perhaps a source of inspiration and the great chefs are a source of creativity. But ultimately, you're writing for people at home, and Food & Wine has always had a long tradition of great recipes and often trying to translate what chefs are doing in restaurants at home. And earlier we were talking about with each other this idea that sort of home comfort food has also risen in a certain way to be the purview of chefs. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between cooking and food and chefs and home?
Yeah, I think as chefs is there, you know, just the whole definition of what a restaurant is has changed. Like, it used to be really a special occasion place mm-hmm. where you would go to celebrate birthdays, or when I was growing up, that's what it was. Mm-hmm. If it was an anniversary, my parents would go out. If it was someone's birthday, we got to go out. But otherwise, it was not like every weekend you would go out. And so much has changed. Someone suggested to me once, and I think it's really interesting, that cell phones have changed a lot of the way restaurants are in people's lives, because it used to be that most restaurants you would make a reservation at, and then you were tied to that reservation. You couldn't necessarily pull your car over and go to a payphone, or you wouldn't bother to do that, to change your reservation or to try and juggle five reservations in a row. But now with a cell phone, it's so easy. You know, you can just, you can make a reservation, you can make a reservation and you can cancel it. You can make five reservations.
You can see
what to order.
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, and as smartphones have come up, that's also changed the way people eat out. But you all of a sudden see the possibility in every restaurant. You see, you're like, I could do this. I could have sushi tonight. No, why would I have sushi when I can go have meatballs? And, you know, I just saw that their meatball special tonight is this.
Interesting.
So.
Well, I love the concept of technology because it's impacted a lot of the way chefs and restaurants operate, even whether it's making reservations online or the whole system. You mentioned David Chang at Co, where it's a total, you know, hands-off fiasco to try to get a reservation there, but it works very well for those of you who can get through. But even we found at the Beard Foundation, it's so much easier to communicate with chefs because they have smartphones or cell phones on the line or where they are. And email was always a disaster because unless you sat at a computer at a desk, you never really had email or dealt with email.
Exactly.
So it's really changed the relationship that people have. You can follow them on Twitter. You can friend them on Facebook and so somehow interact even in a distant, you're not really my friend on Facebook kind of way.
No, it's something we talk about a lot, you know, whether it's like, you know, some of it is like the manners, you know, how you behave at restaurants and if it's cool to take a picture of food. And I've been on panels where we talked about it. And a lot of chefs, you know, think it's a necessary evil. Like you don't really want to watch someone, as a chef, you don't want to watch someone letting your food get cold while they, you know, take 25 cell phone pictures. As I did this morning at Bien Cui. Like, I wouldn't let anyone eat until I took like five pictures of all the croissants on the table.
They were cold already.
They were cold, yeah. That wasn't so dramatic. But, you know, but on the other hand, if a chef is in Japan and getting the most amazing soba noodles or a beautiful kaiseki presentation and they can tweet out that picture, all of a sudden the chef in New York City can see it. It's really great. Daniel Balud was talking about it on this panel I was on and saying he really appreciates it. You know, if you hear so much about a dish at Noma, you know, vintage carrots or langoustine on a rock, and then you actually see a picture of it, it's really impactful.
That's a great topic. We're going to come back to it. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis, and we're talking to Kate Crater, restaurant editor of Food & Wine magazine.
Six-year-old multi-generational family farm that works in cooperation with nature to produce artisan meat that is safe, healthy, nutritious, and good to eat. Without fail, we ensure that our production practices are economically practical, ecologically sustainable, and that the animals are always humanely treated. We never falter in our determination to conduct our business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
And we're back with Taste Matters. And I want to have Mr. Harris on because his accent and his passion that comes through on that about his White Oak Farm meats is just amazing. I mean, I want one right now. We're just talking about the Pavlovian response of food, and we're sitting here looking out the window of the studio with the new on-air light, I'll mention, because our producer Jack is very excited about it. And so are we. It seems like Camp Radio has gotten, you know, one step more retro as we sat here. But we're looking at the bottles of chili oil and the herbs to sprinkle on the pizza here, and we're having this Pavlovian salivary response. which is, I think, speaks to the frenzy that we are of food that we're in the midst of, that there really is an emotional thing. I don't know if it's Pavlovian per se, although certainly that's a part of it, but food isn't just widgets. It isn't just stuff in the same way other things are. We obviously, you have to eat, but that's not food culture. That's sort of biology, almost, eating that way. But all this other stuff we're talking about, the trends, the flavors, the memories. We were talking about Swanson dinners and whether, where it all fits together. It's really so much more encompassing than just biology and nutrients.
It's so funny because some of it's satisfying. I think we've all gotten used to eating a better quality of food in a long, like, I do feel like certainly I've come a long way from the Swanson TV dinners that were my all-time favorite.
We loved when our parents were away because that meant we were going to get them.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. It was better than going to a restaurant. Totally. If I had a choice, I would have said Swanson TV dinner every time.
Maybe they'll be a sponsor of the show anyway.
But I think we were also talking about, what it's like to go get a pizza, and I feel like it's very now, very few people I know will say, like, I'm just going to go grab a slice. It has become almost a competitive thing where you feel like either you have a checklist of what pizzas you haven't had, or you just know and you can say, well, he uses artisanal flour and there, that cheese is hand stretched and blah, 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 blah. So
it's amazing how fast in America, and this is something that I think you probably are in a position to see more than anyone, how fast we adopt things and good and bad. I think it works in both directions, but it, in our lifetimes, pizza has changed in New York City, around the country. We're such good students of things, almost better than some places that take them for granted. It's harder to find a good pizza in Italy, honestly. Everyone's lamenting the loss of pizza, and here we're jumping up and down because there's another Neapolitan certified pizzeria and oven just delivered.
Exactly. Well, it's just amazing and how many different ways they figure out how to make it just a little bit different. They're either like the only ones who are using real Italian canned tomatoes, or they've discovered a new cheese. Right. But there's
a new technique for making the dough, like Jim Leahy.
Exactly.
I mean, the we're talking, obviously, this is inspired by the food section of the New York Times today, which has a giant pizza on it.
It's the pizza issue.
It's the pizza issue. Go figure. In the paper of record in America, one of the papers of record of the world. Let's talk about the world. Just for a small topic, let's talk about someone almost came through the window of the studio. That was
exactly
fun. Let's talk about what's happening here. You are so connected to a world of chefs, and they are increasingly connected, as you said, because of technology, because of the global nature of food, and just the world we live in is so connected. How do you think that's had an impact? Where does America fit in what else is going on around the world when you hang out with Dave Chang and Rene Redzepi and Narasawa from Japan? Like, what is that like? What's the exchange of taste and flavor and culture that's happening there?
Well, I have an idea about it, and I think you actually have one of the best world views of any food lover that I know and food expert. But I'm from New York, so I still believe that New York is the center of the universe on every level. But I think
getting us in trouble here.
Sorry, I have to say it.
And does that include Brooklyn? Because often it's a different place.
Brooklyn, yeah, I have to say, yeah. Brooklyn is definitely part. I'm proud to own Brooklyn in the food in the food world. But I do feel like it's so interesting to see as technology has helped spread the word. I think, I'm not sure how much of an influence Spanish food would have had, how much we would have been obsessed with it if it didn't sort of coincide with a technology, with just this boom in technology. And now you could, instead of just hearing rumors about a chef called Ferran Adrià and some of his experiments, that sound like magic, you actually start to see spherical olives, and you see, it wasn't just a weird rumor. You actually start to see things,
and they appeared on menus, and the technology was shared, and the meetings in Spain begot meetings in Japan, begot meetings in Denmark.
Exactly. And so, so now the worldwide effect is, you can just see it, especially in New York right now. And I do think it's spreading across the country. But one of the huge hot trends here now is Scandinavian food. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a direct result of Noma, mm-hmm. a miraculous restaurant in Copenhagen that has topped the world's 50 best list for the last 2 years, and it's coming up soon. We'll see if it'll be a third year in the row.
Full disclosure, I'm the chair of one of the academies, the region of the Eastern United States, and Kate is a panelist, so she votes among the many hundreds and hundreds of voters around the world. But no one person really can affect that. It's sort of part of the culture. It reflects
what
happens. Yeah.
And so this restaurant, Noma, has caused, like, it's almost single-handedly made Scandinavia a big player in
Right, which is so hard to for even them to imagine.
Yeah, exactly. And so now in New York City, we're seeing a whole bunch of important restaurants have Scandinavian influences where it would have used to be, it definitely would have been Spanish a couple of years ago. You would have said, like, oh, the coolest
right.
new restaurant
but
is...
But that never happened, right? To me, the surprise was the Spanish thing never actually came here in the way, I mean, there were people cooking in that style, quote unquote, molecular gastronomy or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But it was always a little bit surprising to me that we never got a new Spanish restaurant, or did we? Did I miss it?
I mean, not recently, you know, yeah. Tertulia is a restaurant that...
But that's an old Spanish restaurant, really. Yeah, that's not about the new
Spanish restaurant.
Yeah. So something it might be different about the resonance of Scandinavian cuisine. I don't know. Or maybe it's a change in the technology of the time and just the relationship we have to it.
Well, I think for a lot of people, it reflects a breather. We've been so inundated across the country, and not in a bad way, but mm-hmm. there's been this huge, like, everyone, as part of the comfort food, you know, wave, people have embraced Italian, like mm-hmm. sort of their version or their idea of Italian wholeheartedly, whether it's pizza, which is huge right now, to just the whole trattoria thing
right.
where you have like pastas, cacio e pepe, or whether it's like sort of a meat, like, but it's basically a trattoria, like a very comfortable thing and like warm woods. And so there's something about the Scandinavian influence when it comes in. It just feels like a different aesthetic. The
right.
food feels cleaner. I think another
the design
thing,
is different. Everything
the design
about it, right?
is fun. Like, there was a restaurant called Issa in Brooklyn mm-hmm. That I think is actually... on the short list to be one of the best new restaurants in America on the James Beard,
right.
you know,
awards,
for James Beard
yeah.
Awards coming up soon. So the fact that this little restaurant in Brooklyn, and it's not very big, it's hard to get to, it's not near a subway, is on that list is amazing, and I think that says mm-hmm. huge things.
I also think that with the Scandinavian thing, there's a bit of a cultural resonance. Like, when I was a kid, Danish modern design was mm-hmm. from the 50s. We grew up, you know, every piece we could have, mm-hmm. whether it was the teak table or the whatever. When I went to Denmark the first time, ostensibly to eat at Noma as an adult, I was like, oh my God, I had this like weird out-of-body experience because it was the aspirations of our family to have that,
uh-huh.
you know. And now that there's a new Mary Mecco store in New York and all
exactly.
this sort of stuff coming back, I think there's a real fondness for it. It was sort of the groundwork had been laid and everyone was excited to welcome them.
You know? I guess that's true. That's so true. Yeah, it is like, I have to say, Copenhagen is walking into like a giant Mary Mecco store. It's
yeah.
like Mary Mecco all the time.
Mary Mecco all the time. You need sunglasses sometimes.
Exactly.
So I guess for the last bit of the time we have together, which is a shame because it goes so fast and it would be nice. I don't know if anyone would want to listen, but I would certainly want to talk to my guests for all day while we're sitting here at Roberta's. What do you think is the future? I mean, I know we could all make $1 million if we had it, but you spend a lot of time editorially, but also just out and about thinking about what's coming up. And I know chefs are always trying to think of the next thing and deal. What do you think, what do we have to look forward to? What are you seeing that excites you beyond what we've just been talking about?
I have to say right now I'm personally completely obsessed with sandwiches, and it's really
back to the sandwich mavericks.
But yeah. I think it's amazing. I think it's the best confluence of chefs who are really talented turning their attention to a comfort food that's accessible to everyone, that's
right.
affordable, and you can geek out, whether you want to geek out on the bread or you want to geek out on the fillings or you want to make a sauce where you like smoke the ketchup,
right?
You know, I think there's so much possibility there, and it's
Despite the origins of the Earl of Sandwich, it's so American. You eat it with
yeah.
your hands. You know, you can pile the stuff on.
It was secretly invented in America. I feel sure about that. But
and something, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I was just going to say, like, I appreciate the chefs have done great things with burgers, but I feel like burgers have their limit. And I think if you want to, I think there's so much more possibility with mm-hmm. sandwiches. Like, personally, I'm trying to eat more vegetables, less meat. And so my options don't always include a veggie burger. So
right.
I do feel like when you see what chefs are doing with sandwiches, and another thing that's cool is it's all across the country. We were just talking about
right.
a place in Charleston called Butcher and Bee, where there's a chef at the helm who's doing terrific sandwiches. LA is this new sandwich capital of the world. There's, it really is. It's just like what they're doing there is so cool. And I just love that everyone can have one, you know,
right.
that, It's great.
And here's another thing I love about sandwiches, and this to me is sort of the distinction between home cooking and eating out, and that is that to make a complicated sandwich, you're never going to make a very complicated sandwich at home, because if you have to make all of the components for one or two sandwiches, if it's smoking tomato ketchup and a pickle this and a meat that, like, it's so complicated to make one. But mm-hmm. if you have a business, you have them around, and you can make the most complicated sandwich with all these layers of flavor.
Precisely.
And texture, and you can pay $10 for it. That's an expensive one, but it's
you can panko fry your shrimp, and you exactly. can like have four sauces going on. I do
stuff
like,
you won't do at home.
I mean, I do want to encourage people to like make sandwiches a project cooking thing, because I think I think it is fun and you can really impress people. But I think the most beautiful grilled cheese sandwich you can ever have involves like two pieces of good bread, cheese that melts really well, and just a lot of butter. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, and I will say we had breakfast this morning, you and I, with our guest host next week, who's Isabella Wojcik, my colleague and friend, the House Program Director at the Jane Beard Foundation.
Yay.
And what you may not know is she is so ahead of the curve on this, because she is the finest sandwich maker I've ever known.
Oh, my goodness.
Our entire life together, which has been very long, we went to college and lived together for 10 years. Every element of a sandwich that she makes was considered. The flavors, the textures, the biteability, so that it would fit in your mouth, but just so. Like,
oh, my God.
She should have her own, I don't know, her own chain, I think, given she's a real sandwich maverick. And you'll be able to listen to her next week, because she'll be actually not talking about sandwiches, but another favorite topic, the taste of blood.
Whoa.
Not to throw things around, but Isabella will be here talking to Brad Farmery about a growing taste of blood. And we don't mean in the vampire sense, we mean in the chef sense.
But maybe there's a blood sandwich that you don't know about that she's in the process of pioneering.
Maybe there is. Certainly blood sausage, and that's delicious.
Certainly.
And that would be good on a sandwich. I want to thank you, Kate, for coming to
thank
Brooklyn.
Thank you so
well,
much.
Coming to a different part of Brooklyn. You live in Brooklyn, but uh-huh. coming to us, Roberta's in Bushwick. Everyone can follow Kate at Kay Crater, is her Twitter handle. And also you can read what she and her colleagues at Food & Wine are thinking. The Best New Chef magazine is out already, and you can read all about them.
It's actually coming out. It's our July issue, and it comes out in June. So you only have to wait like 2 months, and then you'll see
okay,
it.
Okay, never mind. But you can find out who it is, and there's a People's Choice component this year.
Yeah, we picked a People's Choice winner, who is Tim Byers at Smoke in Dallas, which is, he's great. I've actually gotten to eat at his restaurant. And then our 10 best new chefs are online at foodandwine.com, and they're awesome.
Fantastic. This is Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. Every Wednesday, we talk about taste from 11 to 11:30, and you can listen to us on iTunes or on the Heritage Radio Network website, where all of the shows are archived. Thank you, and eat well.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.